Case number 07-1369 et al. CXSX Transportation, Inc. Petitioner versus Surface Transportation Board et al. Mr. Motes for Railroad Petitioners, Mr. DeMichael for the Shippers Petitioners, and Mr. Atkins for the respondents.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Paul Motes. I appear here today for the railroad petitioners. They are the Association of American Railroads, the Canadian Pacific Railway, CSX Transportation, Norfolk Southern Railway, and the Union Pacific Railroad. These consolidated appeals relate to an STB decision promulgating important changes to the substantive rules and procedures applicable to determination of maximum reasonable rate challenges for so-called medium-sized and small rate cases. Now, we recognize this court has dealt repeatedly, and most recently in 2006, with the board's standards for so-called large cases. These are notably utility coal rate cases. These are very different standards. They have never previously been before you or any other court, although an earlier and less complete version of these rules was before the court and were deemed unripe for review in a decision authored by you, Judge Tatel, in 1998. It's taken notably the board 11 years to refine its rules and for us to get back here. Now, we have explained on brief how the so-called small case or three benchmark, and I will refer to these as the 3B rate standards, constitute very significant departures from the well-established principles of constrained market pricing, CMP, and the standalone cost or SAC standard adopted by the STB. So I won't repeat those points here, but I would like to emphasize that the board has said repeatedly and has acknowledged in its brief on appeal here, quote, CMP provides the only economically precise measure of rate reasonableness and therefore must be used wherever possible, end quote. That's our starting point. What has happened here? The 3B standards are effectively really nothing more than rate comparisons, and I'll talk in a moment about how they are supposed to work. But to have any grounding at all in the CMP principles, they must compare similar current rates to the rates being challenged. The assumption is that the comparable rates reflect or will reflect similar market and demand forces to those that apply to the challenged rates. Now, these revised 3B standards we submit press the very outer boundaries of CMP. And let me be clear, we are not here challenging the validity of the 3B standards. We are certainly challenging the validity of the way the board has proposed those standards to be applied in specific cases. Petitioners maintain that several aspects of the decision have pushed what the board itself has described. These are the board's words describing the 3B methodology, a crude methodology, which is very rough and imprecise. We believe that several aspects of the decision have pushed the crude methodology to the point that there is a virtual certainty that determination of rate reasonableness made using the standards will be completely arbitrary and erroneous. Why is that? It's because the 3B methodology, as I said at the end of the day, is a little bit more, not much more, than a mechanism for making rate comparisons. The methodology works this way. The parties are supposed to select a so-called comparison group of other rail shipments moving on the same railroad, the defendant's railroad system, against which the challenged rate will be gauged. Once that so-called comparison group has been selected, the rate reasonableness determination is made as follows. And this is
Could I just be clear? The board's response, is it not, is that you will have control over selecting that group?
We have control over selecting the group once the board has made clear what data the group will be selected from. Mm-hmm. And that's my real problem. The data.
But to the extent your real problem is, as I understand it, that it's outdated, stale information, you're not required to use the oldest information, are you?
Two responses to that, Judge Rogers. First, you're absolutely right. That is our problem. And I'll just lay it out very simply. In its notice of proposed rulemaking in this proceeding, the board said, what data will we make available for the parties to pick these comparable movements? We will make available, quote, the most recent waybill sample. The waybill sample was defined in the decision, but in essence, it is a sample of carload rail movements on every major Class 1 railroad in the United States. So there's one, for example, for CSX, and I'll use CSX as the example since we have now had 3B cases brought against CSX. the most recent sample is going to have movements that are 1 or 2 years old. It takes, by definition, 1, sometimes 2 years to process the traffic from the prior year to get it into this sample. So that's a problem and an issue, and it's a problem that several of the petitioners.
Doesn't the board allow that information to be updated as a in the category of other factors?
Yes, and I'd like to address other factors separately, but also.
No, but isn't that one of the things that can be
encompassed
in other factors?
Yes, Judge Taylor, it is. But by the time you get to the application of other factors, there's already been a determination of the presumptively reasonable rate made using the comparison data that the board has released.
Yeah, but how I understand your concern about that, but you know we're reviewing this for reasonableness, and how do you make the point that, I mean, I realize you would prefer a different system where the original data they get is absolutely current, right, rather than updating it later as another factor.
Ideally,
but in a simplified system like this, which the statute requires the board to develop, how can what's our basis for saying that's unreasonable? I mean, you haven't really argued that the other factor analysis would preclude you from updating the data.
Well, right? First of all, we tried it in those three CSX cases. We tried it as other factors. We tried introducing evidence of how the rates had changed over the period, the four-year period that the Wabel sample was released for, and the board rejected the evidence. So we don't put a proposal out of confidence.
We're reviewing the regulation here.
You're reviewing the regulation, and my argument is that the board violated the APA in the way that it issued these regulations
But that case isn't before us.
Yes, it is. It's this case right here. Uh-huh. Here, the board said in its notice of proposed rulemaking, we'll make available the most recent Wabel sample.
Right.
Several of the railroads criticized that, pointed out the problems, what we call the regulatory lag that ensures from that. In its final decision, the board, rather than addressing the problem and trying to say here are some ways that the railroads can deal with the regulatory lag, it announced for the first time, with no notice and with no party having suggested to do so, in an appendix, that it would make available 4 years of Waybill data.
Well, but now that issue you didn't file a petition for rehearing on, right?
We did not file a petition for rehearing. We would respectfully submit we don't have to.
Uh-huh.
This is the STB, not the FCC. There is
I know, but there's a. I'm not talking about jurisdiction. I'm talking about exhaustion.
I understand, but the four-year issue of the Waybill sample didn't show up until the decision was issued. It wasn't discussed during the.
But you could have filed a petition for rehearing.
In theory, we could have. We weren't required to do so.
Well. You only had to if that was the only way to present the issue to the agency.
Well, Your Honor, let me see if I can come at this another way. The board in that appendix says we'll release 4 years of Waybill sample data so that shippers can verify the way we calculate what they call the RSAM, the Revenue Shortfall right. Allocation Method, one of the three benchmarks. We, the railroads, still weren't sure that that meant that the board would actually allow 4 years of comparable data to be used in a 3B case. So when CSX had three of those cases filed against it shortly after these regulations were issued by DuPont Corporation, we resisted production and discovery of DuPont's effort to get 4 years of data. They filed a motion to compel, and then the board said, no, we're not going to just release the data for purposes of calculating the RSAM. We're going to release it for all purposes. DuPont, you can use rates that are as much as 5 or 6 years old in this case against CSX, and they did. And even there, to go back to your earlier question, then we said, okay, as other relevant factors, we're going to introduce evidence of how much the rates had changed.
Mm-hmm.
We introduced evidence in that case that the rates had increased by 100% over the 5 to 6 year period that the Waybill sample dealt with. Bear in mind, rail rates have gone up very, very dramatically in the most recent period of time. This is a very significant issue. At the end of the day, the 3B standards come down to let's compare the rate at issue today, the current rate, with the comparison group rates, which, as I'm now explaining, can go back as far as 5 or 6 years. A lot happens in 5 or 6 years. I wouldn't want to have the price of a house I bought today determined by what the price might have been 5 or 6 years ago. Actually, in this environment, maybe I would. But in more normal times, I wouldn't want that to happen. And that's what the board is doing. Not only is it saying use the old data, but it's then this mechanism is, quote, here's the test. Adjust each movement in the comparison group by the ratio of the RSAM, that is how much over variable costs the railroad would have to raise the rates on all of its captive traffic to earn adequate revenues. Divide that by RVC greater than 180, which is the amount that the railroad earns today from traffic, the markup that it earns over variable costs. and then calculate a confidence interval around the estimate of the mean of the adjusted comparison group and presume unreasonable a challenge rate that's above the confidence interval. That's a lot of statistical words, but what it means at the end of the day is if you're above the interval, you're at the high end of the interval, your rate's unreasonable. What that's going to do, of course, is ensure, particularly with using comparison data that's old and where the rates were lower, it's going to ensure that rates challenged that way are going to come down, down, down. It's a recipe for constant ratcheting down of railroad rates.
I want to be clear on one thing, though. When you were reciting to us what had happened in these other cases, you said, well, the ALJ rejected the evidence.
Not the ALJ, the board.
The
board doesn't have
it. But in the CSX case, you tried to introduce evidence of current rates.
We did introduce evidence of current rates.
And the board, that's my point. Yeah. It was introduced, but...
And the board gave it no weight.
Yeah. All right.
The other point that I'd like to mention briefly, and then I'll sit down, is the... we have also challenged the board's decision here that it would not allow any movement-specific adjustments to average system costs. And I know this is going to sound familiar, Judge Rogers. This was an issue in the case before you a couple of years ago, the large rate standard cases. But in 1996, in adopting the predecessor to these guidelines, the board said the greater accuracy is obtained through movement-specific costing, and that's preferable to reliance on system average costing. Now, here we are a decade later, and the board said we're not going to allow any adjustments whatsoever. And bear in mind, the big thrust here was simple and easy. That was what the board's mantra for making these rules. So we said, okay, so why can't we introduce evidence of that type if it doesn't require discovery? The board is very worried about burdening shippers with discovery. And the board said, no, our experience.
Did you make that case before the board, that is, that this could be done without discovery?
I think the board argues on brief that we made that point for the first time here.
Yes, they do. That's why I asked the question. Is that wrong?
I think that, well, first of all, the board's right in its brief. We did not make that argument before it. But it wasn't clear to us, again, that the nature of the no adjustment rule would be as severe as it was until we actually had experience in these CSX cases. And I realize I keep referring to those cases. We brought them here. They were decided. The railroad lost. We filed all three here, petitions for review. This court set a briefing schedule. We filed our opening brief. 2 days later, the board asked that the cases be remanded, and they're back at the board now. I'd like to save some time for rebuttal, so I probably should stop at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Counsel for the shippers. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Nicholas DeMichael, and I represent the shipper petitioners in this proceeding. We've raised two issues in this proceeding. First, arguing that the level of the relief caps established by the board are arbitrary and capricious and not in accordance with law. And we've also argued that the simplified SAC methodology is an arbitrary and capricious departure from the board's precedent. With the Court's permission, I'm going to focus my remarks on the first of these issues, but would, of course, be very pleased to take questions you have concerning the second. Looking at the first issue, the level of the relief caps, under the statute, the Board is required to establish a simplified and expedited method for determining the reasonableness of challenged rail rates in those cases in which a full standalone cost presentation, the full SAC presentation, is, quote, too costly given the value of the case. Thus, under the statute, the board is required to consider when a case is too costly and also to establish a method of determining a reasonable rate when that case is too costly. In its decision, the board adopted a limit to relief approach, and under this approach, a potential complainant can choose to file a complaint under any of the methodologies, under any of the three methodologies.
And you didn't object to the limit to relief approach. You just object to the particular limit to relief approach. But as a conceptual matter, you're okay with that?
That's right. As a conceptual matter, we're okay with a limit to a relief approach. But the statute, we believe, requires the board to make a judgment as to whether that limit to relief is sufficient. And let me, in fact, quote the board's decision. The board did what they did here in dealing with a relief cap. And the board said that a relief cap approach must make it, and I'm quoting the decision here, cost-effective to pursue either a three-benchmark or simplified SAC presentation by providing an ample cushion between the cost to bring a case and the potential relief available. And the board held, in fact, that that ample cushion was necessary for the statutory determination because it said, again, quoting, a simplified presentation would not be cost-effective unless the potential relief exceeds the expected cost of obtaining the remedy by a sufficient margin to make it worthwhile to pursue the case. So you need an ample cushion. You need a sufficient margin. And the board,
those are pretty soft terms, aren't they?
Well, they are, but they do have a meaning. And what the board said is that there needs to be enough of a cushion to make it worthwhile. If you simply get back what you would spend to bring a complaint, you have a remedy that's illusory. But having set out the problem correctly,
the $1 million and $5 million limits provide every shipper with a potential case with sufficient net relief after litigation costs to justify bringing a complaint under three benchmarks or simplified SAC. And then it goes on and says, thus every complainant will have a vehicle to pursue its complaint regardless of the value.
Your Honor, the board said that, but they didn't analyze that. They didn't take a look at whether that was true or not. They simply said it as an ipse dixit.
I thought your objection was that the board had not considered. You're not arguing this, that simplified SAC or the benchmark approach.
Yes.
This is a complicated case. We had three bench memos in it. So. You're not suggesting that this does not produce reasonable rates. You're just saying the board didn't address that issue, right?
The board did not address that issue. The board simply said.
I just read you a sentence where it did address it, and it concluded. You just don't like the conclusion.
No, we do not. The conclusion.
What more should it have done?
But the board did not address the issue either.
Well, I just read you the sentence where it addressed it. And then you agreed with me that it addressed it, but it was conclusory.
I believe, Your Honor, that the board had to take a look. The board just couldn't simply say, we believe that there is that a case. The board had to take a look at actually the range of potential values in the case and decide for a reasonable range of values whether there is that sufficient margin, whether there is that ample cushion that the board said was necessary. The board actually took a look at simply two case values. Yeah. The board took a look at a case value of $1 million and the board took a look at a case value of $5 million and said if you take that case value and divide that case value by the cost of bringing that case, you get a four or five to one margin. And the board said, well, isn't that sufficient? And for those two case values, we agree, but what the board didn't do, and the board didn't recognize that obviously you have case values that extend from a small amount of money up to a very large amount of money, and there are a significant range of values that there is not a sufficient margin, or it's at least not anywhere close to the 4 or 5 to 1. If you take a look, for example, at page 19 of the board's brief, which replicates the chart at page 32 of the board's decision. And that shows a chart showing what the cost of the case and the value of the case is. And if you simply insert any value between the $1 million cost of a three benchmark, excuse me, the $1 million value of a three benchmark case and the $5 million value of a simplified SAC, something like a $2 million value, it could be anything. And you insert another value between the $5 million value of a simplified SAC case and the no limit value of a full SAC case, and you simply then ask yourself, well, if I pick a number anywhere else, does it develop a cushion, a risk factor that is even close to the 4 or 5 to 1? Does it do anything? And more precisely, did the board look at that?
What would require the board to do this? It responded to your concern. You objected to the system. You said it didn't produce reasonable rates. They looked at that conclusion. They looked at some examples, and they reached the conclusion that that it will produce reasonable rates, given the simplified nature of it.
If the board basically looked at two values. The board looked at the $1 million value right. case and a $5 million value case. If the board would have taken a series of cases that would have fallen somewhere in a range and say we've looked at all of those and they all produce a cushion, a reasonable cushion,
your problem is buying into the limit to relief approach. Anytime you're going to have a limit to relief approach that has steps involved in it, you're always going to have these tensions at the margin. You're going to have some people who have greater incentives than do others, and that's your problem. You're complaining about the $2 million case and where the incentives are. Do you go after the simplified SAC, which is going to cost you a whole lot but get a little return, or do you go for the cheaper version? But aren't you going to have that any time you have the limit to relief approach?
You are going to have a tension or a break no matter where you set the break. But the point of this is the board said you needed to have an ample cushion. We have no problem with forfeiting a certain amount of relief as long as—
And the board recognized that. The board knew that the simplified system would result in forfeiting some relief.
And we have no problem with that, as long as when you do the next most complex method, you can do it under a reasonable cushion that the board itself said was necessary to have.
But again, aren't you going to always run into that problem when you have limits for relief and you have steps as you get as you approach the cap? You're going to always have that problem that you're describing right now. So that's why I say your problem is that you bought into the limits for relief approach. That would be your better argument.
If you take a look at the joint appendix, and especially the charts at pages 315, I believe, 315 and 328, I believe. excuse me, 328 and 326. You'll see charts there that show how the risk factors change at various case levels. And it's true, once you hit the next case level, the risk factors drop. But the point of it is the risk factors should drop to a point that you still have an ample cushion. But the board never even analyzed whether you have an ample cushion.
The ample cushion language comes from the board itself, right?
The ample cushion language comes from the board's
decision. Own language. So you have to read their conclusions, I think, in terms of they said there has to be an ample cushion. And then they looked at some of these cases and they concluded, they said, ultimately, we do not think it is improper for there to be some trade-off involved in using a simpler, faster, and less costly method that is inherently less precise, right?
And they say
this all in the context of having earlier said there has to be an adequate cushion, and then they conclude by saying that their simplest, quote, struck the right balance, the appropriate balance, so that we do not open the door to excessive litigation under methods that are not justified for the amount in dispute. So I don't know how you can read this other than the board concluding that the simplified systems do provide the adequate cushion necessary to provide a reasonable rate.
The board said that at these two points there is a cushion, there is a cushion of 4 or 5 to 1. The board ignored evidence showing that the cushion at different levels was far lower. The board never addressed the point whether that far lower cushion was still ample, and that's what we're saying here, that the board, having set up a standard, which we think is the correct standard, never analyzed whether that standard was actually met at case values other than the two case values that it reviewed. I would maybe just make one more point here in terms of the board's analysis. The board's brief, I believe it's page 45. Talks about the standard that the board looked at, or it really urges the court to say that the board should be affirmed as long as a case is not evidently unviable. That standard does not appear in the board's decision. It appears in the board's brief. It suggests, I believe, that the board knows that it did not, that it, in a sense, is trying to lower the standard before this court, and the board's decision did not, in fact, take a look at the question that under the standard that, that the board itself opposed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, counsel for the board.
May it please the court, my name is Raymond Atkins, representing the Surface Transportation Board and the United States government. In this rulemaking, the board created two simplified alternatives to the full standalone cost presentation, the simplified SAC and the three benchmark approach. And as you've heard, the shippers and railroads have different views on the merits of those two alternatives. But in the board's judgment, both of those serve an important public purpose. As between the two, the simplified SAC is the preferred approach. It is a cost-based approach that compares the challenged rate against the cost of owning and operating the rail facilities in question. But then the agency went on to explain that it needed a second alternative because there were a lot of shippers that would be unable to use the simplified SAC approach. So it retained the three benchmark approach, but was very careful to minimize the litigation costs of that approach so as to preserve its intended purpose. And as this court has observed, even in the largest of cases before the agency, the pursuit of accuracy gives way to the constraints of time and expense, and it is the agency's responsibility to mark where that point is. Now, unless you'd like me to start somewhere else, I intend on addressing first the question of eligibility and the limits on relief, and then turning to the question of regulatory lag, and then concluding by talking about the movement-specific adjustments.
You're going to start with the rate caps?
The rate caps,
okay,
yes.
That's a good place to start.
Good. Here the board, in its decision, acknowledged that there was a profound complication associated with it trying to judge where the value, a likely value of a case without prejudging the merits of it. So it adopted a alternative, the small claims approach, under which it is the shipper himself who judges the strengths and weaknesses of their own case.
Well, they don't object to that.
Right.
Nobody objects to that.
What they
object their objection to. Is that the system you came up with, that there's no, the board has not determined that it will produce reasonable rates. That's their objection.
Right, that we failed entirely, the board failed entirely to consider two relevant factors. But as Your Honor pointed out, the board did in fact consider those relevant factors.
But they say, you just heard him, they say that's just conclusory. What they want the board to do, is they wanted the board to pick a case. They wanted the board to pick a value that below which full SAC was clearly too costly, okay, and show that it would, in simplified SAC, produce a reasonable price. Like they wanted you to take like $9 million and the board to analyze that and say, somebody with a $9 million claim using simplified SAC will end up with a reasonable rate. That's what they want.
They wanted the board to look at a range of values. You're correct, Your Honor.
Right.
And the board did. Uh-huh. In the language that you quote on reconsideration, the board stated that there was sufficient net relief for every shipper.
Right.
It also cited the evidence that it relied upon.
They say if you look at specific examples of
That's right, Your Honor. And the board
might not be the case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the board cited those specific examples. It cited Table 1C of the shipper's evidence on reconsideration. You can find that table at Joint Appendix 330. That is a table that walks through the different likely values of the case, starting with $750,000 and going incrementally all the way up to $4 million. And for each of those expected values of the case, The shippers themselves demonstrated that there was going to be, in the board's judgment, sufficient net relief. So they are dead wrong, Judge Tatel, when they say that the only two numbers the board looked at was one in $5 million. So their claim that the board failed entirely to consider a relevant factor is wrong. The board did consider that factor, but this was a balancing test. This was balancing the two conflicting goals, the goal of whether the shippers would have sufficient access against the competing interest in not having cases judged under increasingly less precise alternatives. And so it was the agency's job to balance those competing factors, and it did conclude that 1 in 5 would be sufficient. However, then they have a second factor, which is the limits on rate approach does require them to make some difficult choices. Again, the board did consider that factor. As Judge Griffith noted, it stated that it made two observations. One, that will be true no matter where they set the limit on relief. And they also observed that it would be it's a proper trade-off to use a simpler, faster, less costly method that is inherently less precise. Again, this is exactly the type of balancing that is in the purview of the board, so long as the board has considered all of the relevant factors, which it did here.
Could the board have set the caps too low to have violated the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the board believed it would. So take, for example, if it had set the limit on 3 benchmark at $300,000,
yeah.
Cost $250,000 to bring it, the board's ample cushion had to be between the cost of bringing a particular type of case and the relief that would be available under that type of case. And the board believed in order for this to be a genuine alternative for small shippers, there had to be enough of a cushion, which there clearly is. It costs $250,000 estimated to bring a 3 benchmark case. You can get up to $1 million in relief.
So how would you describe our review of those decisions? What are we to do? How would you describe how we're to review this?
You will look to see if the board considered a factor which is inappropriate, or failed entirely to consider a relevant factor, or the outcome is so implausible that it cannot be the product of agency expertise. Okay.
And that would have been the case if they had set the cap at $300,000
probably would be. We'd be in a much more difficult position.
How would I know that that's not implausible, but what the board came up with is plausible?
Well,
how do I know that?
Right. Well, that's a judgment call for Your Honors, but
that's what we do. But I'm trying to figure out what. How do I know that?
You'd ask yourself is the limitation that it's set reasonable? Is the structure of its approach reasonable? And I would say it is.
Okay.
Let me explain.
If you're writing the opinion on this, what would the sentence say as to why the $1 million cap is reasonable, but the $300,000 cap would be implausible?
Because
the council, your opponent, the shippers here, believe that the current caps are implausible.
That's right.
Right.
You would say that the board's decision is correctly noted that in order for this to be an effective alternative, there must be a difference between the maximum relief you can get under the approach and the cost of litigating it. Otherwise, nobody brings a case. And then you would review that, deferring to the agency's judgment.
Take a $9 million case.
Right, a $9 million case. Well, again, Your Honor, the board said not all $9 million cases are the same, right? No, it's quite serious, because if you have a $9 million case and you've judged it, and that's the expected value of the case, that means you've already looked at it and you've said, well, there might be a probability I'll get $100 million, probability I'll lose the case, and so I weigh and I come up with an expected value of $9 million. If the expected value of your case is $9 million, taking into consideration the litigation risks, and it costs you $5 million to bring the case, you have two viable options. You can either pursue a full SAC case, you're only going to expected net will only be $4 million, or you can take advantage of the massive simplifications associated with the simplified SAC, save yourself $4 million, but you're going to have to agree to a limit on relief of $5 million. You're going to be largely indifferent between the two. And so the board stated in its decision, this was a difficult task to try and structure where these limits should fall. It indicated it will continue to monitor them to make sure that they comport with the objective, but in the agency's judgment, based on the record that was presented, they do provide sufficient net relief, and it is appropriate for there to be some trade-off. Let me turn to the question of regulatory lag. As Your Honors are probably familiar with, because of the nature of data collection, there's always going to be some regulatory lag associated with rate making. And the way the board dealt with that issue here is quite reasonable. What it proposed to do is use the best available data set to determine the 3 benchmarks. And then it would permit the parties to rebut that presumption with case-specific information and the other relevant factors. Now, as Judge Rogers has observed, There is no requirement in the rule that the comp group be drawn from a multi-year analysis. The board clarified immediately after these rules were issued that it simply defined the universe from which you could draw the comp group. Parties were free to argue for a narrower single-year comp group. And since the DuPont case has been discussed so liberally here, I'll note, Judge Rogers, that in the first case before the agency, both the railroad and the shippers advocated for a multi-year comparison group. And that railroad is one of the petitioners here and was represented by Mr. Oates. So the arguments they've got here about how regulatory lag is such a significant problem are not matched by their actions before the agency. And again, the question of then how do you update to address information that's not in the waybill? Well, that would be done through the other relevant factors, which is a reasonable approach. The board has to make a decision based on the evidence that's presented, and then it creates a burden on either side. The shipper can also come in and argue that circumstances have changed and should justify a lower result. Or the railroads can come in and say circumstances have changed and justify a higher result, and the burden would be on whatever party is seeking a departure from what the best available data set and would indicate. I would submit, Your Honors, that there is nothing unsound or unreasonable about that approach for dealing with regulatory lag. Now, there is a procedural claim raised by the railroads that was discussed briefly about whether or not the decision to expand the scope of the waybill was a logical outgrowth of the notice. Again, as Judge Taylor, as you noted, they did not present this issue below, which we maintain they are required to do under the Tucker Truck Doctrine. And again, this is not, we're not arguing that this court lacks jurisdiction. This is not an exhaustion of remedies type claim. What we're arguing is it's an issue preclusion. It's a issue exhaustion claim, which is a judicially created doctrine, which does apply to rulemakings, and which this court has said notice and comment are the perfect types of issues to raise. But moreover, turning to the merits, it was a logical outgrowth. In the original notice, what the board proposed was to draw the comp group in the notice, the comp group was to be, quote, drawn from the waybill sample provided to the parties by the board, end quote. That was the notice. The notice then later said it intended to release, quote, all movements in the most recent waybill sample that have the same two-digit stick code as the issue movement and with an RVC ratio above 180. So when it presented what it proposed to do in terms of the release of the data, it actually had a number of qualifications. The comments that the board received persuaded it needed to change the release of the waybill data in four different respects. It was going to narrow it just to the defendant carrier. It was going to permit unmasked revenue. It was going to permit all data, not just traffic below 180 or traffic with the same two-digit stick code, and it would do so to correspond to the 4 years of the RSAM. Why? Because the board observed that it was necessary to give the shipper that data so they could verify the two other benchmarks that were going to be used to judge its case. Otherwise, quote, we would have a problem of calculating two benchmarks based on confidential information to which the shippers would not otherwise have access and that had not been the subject to the rigors and scrutinies of the litigation process. Joint Appendix at 101. It's logical, Your Honors, if the board puts on the table 1 year, it's logical right from the outset that the board may say 2 years, it may say 6 months, that temporal limit may change based on the comments received. Otherwise, the agency has no flexibility to respond to the comments it received.
And you're saying these comments, where you said the board decided it needed to make four changes, are all consistent with extending the number of years?
One of the reasons it narrowed the scope of the waybill to just the defendant carrier, that one's independent. That was for a different reason. All the other reasons were to so they could verify the RSAM and the RVC 180 calculations. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So I would argue, Your Honors, that you can either dismiss their procedural claims for waiver or you can dismiss them on the merits. Pick your poison. That leaves the question of movement-specific adjustments to ERCs. I think we can quickly dispense with this line of argument, Your Honor. The board had a long and torrid history with these adjustments, and it recently concluded with this court's approval that these adjustments are too expensive for full stack cases, and they're not contributing to the accuracy of the variable cost estimation. And this court has already reviewed that lengthy rulemaking and affirmed those that decision. This is supposed to be a simplification of the full SAC analysis. It makes no sense whatsoever to introduce that type of evidence into a three benchmark case. Indeed, the reasons are even more compelling. The value of the case is going to be a fraction of that of the larger cases. And to have any value, you're going to have to do these movement-specific adjustments to every candidate movement in the comp group, which is thousands of movements. So permitting the discovery needed for movement-specific adjustments to even a fraction of the comparison group would destroy any semblance of a simplified alternative. If your honors have no further questions,
All of that cover as well the refusal, the same argument as to evidence of product or geographic competition?
Yes, Your Honor. Same rationale. And again, the argument that that wasn't a logical outgrowth, one of the carriers themselves asked the board to change its rule to permit the introduction. I would submit that a party having asked the board to permit it can't be surprised by a decision that says no. Let me conclude by saying, Your Honors, that this was one of the most complicated and controversial rulemakings the board has ever undertaken. It required it to make hundreds of interrelated decisions on how best to structure a simplified alternative to the full SAC. And given that Congress delegated this complex matter to the board, where it operates at the zenith of its rate-making authority, I would urge you to not upset the judgment of the agency and to deny the petitions for review.
Thank you. All right. How are we on time here? How about counsel? Well, why don't we give you a minute or so? Give each counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Paul Motes for Railroad Petitioners. A number of points were made. Let me try to address a few very quickly. First, I don't want the court to think that these three benchmark standards are virtually insignificant. They're small. They're unimportant. Shipper can get up to $1 million of relief in a single benchmark case. The board, Joint Appendix 57, says that 45% of all regulated rail traffic would be subject to the three benchmark standards. Mr. Atkins, at one point, referred to the three benchmark standards as a way to offer genuine relief for small shippers. I had a hard time keeping a straight face. We argued throughout this rulemaking they should be limited to small shippers. They said small shipments. Who are the companies that have used the three benchmark standards? DuPont, in the older iteration of these, BP, Amoco, and Olefins Corporation. They're not small shippers.
By the way, if we were to conclude that the simplified SAC satisfied the board's statutory obligation, let's just assume for a minute that we were to conclude that. The statute doesn't require the board to develop two alternatives,
it
just
does not.
One. So if we concluded that simplified SAC was okay, why would we even have to look at the $1 million one?
I don't think you would. Okay. We're not here arguing for that position, but I take your point. I think it's a valid one. Mm-hmm. Important point here. The comments received by the board from everybody, nobody sought an extension of the period for the way bill from 1 year to 4 years. Nobody addressed that point because the board never hinted that it was thinking of doing that. No comment addressed the issue. The board did this sua sponte on its own in the final decision. That's the first time we ever saw it. Mr. Atkins faults us or says that in the DuPont case that we keep talking about, that is the 3B cases that are back at the board, that both the railroad and DuPont advocated for four-year comparison groups. Yes, because as I explained my first time up here, we strongly urged the board to limit the way bill to 1 year. DuPont, represented as it happens by Mr. DeMichael, argued for the release of the multiple years, and the board agreed with them and granted the 4 years of waybill access. That having once been done, we were between the proverbial rock and hard place. The board's procedure for determining which comparison group to use, that suggested by the railroad or that suggested by the shipper, is baseball arbitration type. It won't look at the two groups and try to figure out what makes the most sense if you put them together. They say, you know, shipper, you advocate, railroad, you advocate, we'll pick one or the other. We felt a litigation judgment that, frankly, we didn't want to run the risk of not using all 4 years if they were going to use all 4 years. Finally, you know, we haven't talked as much here or at all, really, about something we made quite a point of in our brief, and I don't want it to go by the boards. That is, the board here on appeal seeks to escape its responsibility for addressing the regulatory lag problem by blaming us, the railroad petitioners, for not providing an adequate solution to the problem. But with all respect, we believe that it is clearly the board's role to fashion rational, coherent rules.
Well, and if you just interrupt, if I may, counsel, sure. This is rebuttal, and if it's in your brief, isn't waived.
Thank you. We would welcome the chance on remand to deal with the issue. Thank you.